From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Actually, hosting the Dave Graham Show today while Dave is away on vacation is former Vermont Governor Jim Douglas. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Dana. Say, do you get a vacation or just Dave?
Oh, yes, I do. Oh. Yeah, I had my vacation a little earlier this summer. It was wonderful.
It was a great day, I'm sure.
It was, yeah.
Okay. I understand.
I had to be back after lunch.
I know the Radio Vermont personnel policies. Well, great to be with you this morning, and we've got a jam-packed show, so I want to get to it in just a moment. But let me tell you what's coming up. In our first half hour, we're going to talk with Professor Matt Dickinson of Middlebury College. He's a presidential scholar. He's written widely. He blogs regularly, and he follows the presidential campaign trail quite closely, so that'll be an interesting discussion. In the second half hour, we're going to talk with Lindsay Curley, who's the newly anointed and appointed Secretary of Commerce and Community Development. She has been the Labor Commissioner for the first couple and a half years of Governor Scott's administration, so we'll talk with her about her new beat. And then after the 10 o'clock news, we're going to hear from His Excellency himself. Governor Scott will be with us in studio to talk about the recent legislative session, not too recent, I guess, but the most recent one, and his priorities and how things stand with our state. And we'll wrap it up with Steve Perkins in the last half hour. He's the director of the Vermont Historical Society. He's doing a fine job there, and a lot of exciting things happening as we study and learn about our past. So let's kick it off with Professor Matt Dickinson from Middlebury College. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for being available this morning. And in a sense, I guess it seems awfully early to be talking about the 2020 cycle. I sometimes envy my Canadian friends who have much briefer campaign seasons. But of course, it's good for political scientists, right, to have a lengthy campaign season. So here we are. And I'm interested in your perspective at this point. The Democrats are out there campaigning around the country. I know you've attended some of their rallies in our neighboring state. That's the advantage of the convenience of the first in the nation primary next door. So give us a sense of the field now and how you see it unfolding.
Well, it is early, and that means we have to be somewhat cautious in interpreting the signals that political scientists rely on to try to take some measure of where the race stands, and obviously polling is a crucial one, but also endorsements and money raised. With that caveat, the indicators suggest nationally that Joe Biden remains the front runner, and then there's a couple of candidates splitting what we might think of as the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and that, of course, is your former, current Vermont colleague, Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, and, of course, Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. And they're splitting. Biden is pulling about a third of the vote, maybe less, nationally, and Warren and Sanders are splitting about 40% between them, roughly 15 to 20 each. But, of course, the race isn't run nationally. It's run sequentially, and as you point out, I've been fortunate enough to go next door to New Hampshire and attend some rallies there. And I think the biggest and perhaps the most important point here is that the Democratic Party itself, I think, is searching for some sense of where it is ideologically and in terms of policy and in terms of generation. And so it's really a fascinating process of seeing how each of these individual candidates out on the campaign stump frames their messages, because obviously the frame, and as you know from running for office, you choose a frame that you think articulates what you believe in, but does so in a way that's going to attract maximum support. And, at the risk of simplification, what I'm seeing is two types of candidates. The progressives are pushing the message that it's time for a new generation, a new message. The party has moved left and the country is ready to embrace progressive policies. And then the second set of candidates are saying, hold on, the most important issue here is defeating Donald Trump. And so what you really need to do is nominate a candidate who has a track record of getting things done, who may not be so progressive or too progressive, and that he will alienate these moderate voters in the general election. And, you know, I'm not sure which one of those messages is going to win at this stage.
Well, as you point out, Vice President Biden seems to be hanging on to his lead. As a number of observers have suggested, he is gaffe-prone, and the media have a field day whenever he commits one of those. There's also the age factor. He's not the oldest candidate in the race, but the second oldest. Could some of those issues begin to eat away at his front-runner support?
I think they could. I think part of the issue here is he has name recognition, but that may be masking soft support. So a lot of this early polling, for instance, one of the interesting little factoids is the second choice of most Bernie Sanders supporters is Joe Biden. And on the face of it, that doesn't seem to make much sense because they're running on slightly different platforms. Obviously, Biden more on electability and issues that he championed back in the 70s, whereas Bernie Sanders is pushing this new generational thing. So it makes you think maybe some of Biden's supporters are very soft in the gaffes. I think the gaffes, and you know this, you know, one or two gaffes is going to be dismissed. If there's a pattern of them that then can be framed as indicating, for instance, maybe age is catching up with you, then it becomes an issue.
I think that's right. It's interesting also that we've got two candidates running in the New Hampshire primary from adjacent states. Ordinarily, those in the neighborhood would have an edge, but we've got two of them. So what about that dynamic?
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, Bernie Sanders really attracted national attention when he defeated Hillary Clinton in 2016 in New Hampshire by a wide margin. And I was attending rallies at that time, and except for Donald Trump, his rallies were by far the largest that I had seen, and you could see that he was catching on. He is not polling nearly as well this time around. And now he's making a conscious effort to hold smaller, more intimate rallies in an effort to get to know the real Bernie. But having said that, you know, Elizabeth Warren is hanging in there very well, and of course she has that favorite son or favorite daughter recognition as well. The other issue for them, of course, is they're appealing to the same type of voter. Both of them are pushing progressive messages with slightly different tints, I think. I think Bernie is much more willing to burn the system down, and Warren is basically saying the system can work if you get better people in it. How that will play out in New Hampshire, I don't know. And again, you know, there are, as you well know, even in the Democratic Party, there are New Hampshire voters who are iconoclastic and sort of in a libertarian sense. And, you know, Pete Buttigieg is doing quite well there. We were just at a rally a week and a half ago, and it was by far the biggest rally we saw. And it was hosted by a New Hampshire political activist who's been hosting these things for a couple of decades. He said it was the biggest rally he's seen since Al Gore in 1996. Now, I don't know what to make of that, but I wouldn't immediately give this state to either Warren or Sanders.
We're talking with Matt Dickinson, professor of political science at Middlebury College, about the forthcoming, believe it or not, 2020 presidential cycle. Let me ask you about the timing, Matt, because you've consistently cautioned the public against drawing any premature conclusions, and my memory isn't perfect, but at this point in 2004, I think Howard Dean was leading the field. In 2008, Hillary Clinton was way ahead in the primary nominating process. So things can change, can't they? And I think your advice would be not to rely too heavily on polls at this point.
That's absolutely right. In part, question of name recognition is driving the surveys. One of the things that we ask people is, have you ever heard of a candidate? Or if you've heard of a candidate, do you have an opinion of them? And beyond Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, the number of people who have not heard of the other candidates who might have heard of them but have no opinion can range from, you know, almost a third of those surveyed don't really know enough about Elizabeth Warren to have an opinion to, you know, up to 70% who have no idea who Julian Castro is or Pete Buttigieg or some of these other candidates. So you are absolutely right. Very early, very volatile, a lot of behind churning going on here in terms of trying to line up endorsements and strategy. One of the things to think about impact of the debates. We have a couple debates coming up here in September, and if you cannot get on the debate stage, we've seen a couple of candidates drop out, and there'll be some more movement, but the real movement doesn't really take place until the voting in Iowa, beginning in early February next year, and then, of course, in New Hampshire a week later. That's when we'll really see the field win out.
It's interesting that you mentioned the winnowing in the debate process. One of those who's not going to be on the stage is Governor Steve Bullock of Montana, and he pointed out recently that the Republicans 4 years ago had a lower threshold to get on the debate stage, and we, of course, saw 17 of them at one point. And he said, ironically, the Republicans are more Democratic than the Democrats. That large field on the stage didn't hurt the Republicans last time. Why do you think the Democrats are trying to narrow it down early?
Well, I think their rationale is they want to winnow this field early from what they might think are peripheral or second-tier candidates who have no realistic hope of winning the nomination. And that's an understandable impulse, but if you're Steve Bullock or one of these other candidates who you think have a credible candidacy and a record of accomplishment, and what's interesting in the Democratic field is when you look at these, you know, these former governors or, you know, John Hickenlooper was in for a while before turning his sights on the Senate race in Colorado, but certainly Bullock, they want to argue if people get to know us, and the debate is really the best opportunity to do that, we'll begin to resonate with them. So these rules are really, in that sense, counterproductive to these second-tier candidates. You're not going to have a Jimmy Carter coming out of nowhere the way he did in 1976 under the current debate rules. The other thing it has done, counterintuitively, you know, to get on the debate stage, you have to show some broad support, and the way you show that is by, you know, raising at least a dollar from individual contributors, and you need $130,000. So this means somebody like Tom Steyer, who has more money than you and I can imagine, is out there trying to get financial contributions, and it's kind of a perverse incentive. But again, you know, the Democratic Party is trying to, the establishment is trying to winnow that field very early to focus on what they consider to be the most viable candidates.
Matt Dickinson, a professor of political science at Middlebury. We've got a call from a listener. Let's go to Guy in Berlin. You're on the air with Professor Dickinson.
You mentioned that Bernie drew the biggest crowds of anyone except for Trump. And I went to the Trump rally down in Manchester. I was just blown away. 11,000 people in the stands, 1,000 people on the floor, 5,000 people outside. And I just really wonder what, first of all, have you been to one of those events, Professor? And what do you make of his ability to draw these crowds consistently? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, Guy, that's a great question. And as Governor Douglas is fond of reminding me, in 2016, 2015, I confidently predicted that Donald Trump's candidacy would last, you know, about a New York minute.
I wasn't going to bring that up.
and I was wrong. And what that taught me was, you know, you need to actually go to these rallies, talk to people, and figure out where this support is coming from. And so that's what I did in 2016. I attended several Trump rallies in New Hampshire, in New York, in South Carolina, did a lot of listening to people who were supporting him. And it was an eye-opening experience. It not only raised a cautionary flag about relying on national news media to understand a phenomenon, but it also reminded the importance of just doing, you know, anthropological work on the ground and let people tell us what they thought rather than sort of inferring their motives. Now, I haven't been to a Trump rally this time around. I intend to do that, but I have seen a couple on TV. The dynamics from afar seem the same. And to get the guy's question, what really motivated Trump supporters in 2016, and I'm assuming there's this element remains, although I'm curious what you think, Governor Douglas, a lot of it was a sense that the system had failed them. In some ways, it was similar to what was motivating support for Bernie Sanders. It wasn't so much, you know, economic anxiety, although that was part of it. But again and again, we heard people say, this notion of the American dream is increasingly receding from us, that the system is rigged. It's rigged towards people who have the means of influencing outcomes, who have the advantages. It's not fair in a way that we were taught that if you played by the rules and you worked hard, your kids would be positioned to do better than you did. And they no longer trusted that system in the broad sense of the word. And Donald Trump, as the most anti-establishment candidate out there, somebody who could realistically say, I wasn't part of the system, or as he often said, I understood how the system works because I took advantage of it. He suddenly, became the candidate of choice. Now, 4 years later, it's slightly different, right? Because he is part of the system. And that's where I think the dynamic is going to be interesting, to see whether his chaotic tendencies and the controversies, the repeated controversies he's involved in, whether that is going to hurt him in trying to expand beyond those core partisans who are just, are still supporting him and sort of move into maybe what we might call the more independent-minded voters who swing back and forth between the two parties and who in the 2018 midterms more often than not went for these Democratic candidates.
I think your analysis is exactly right. People feel the system was rigged against them. He was ready to go to Washington and drain the swamp, and didn't hurt his chances that the Democratic nominee, Secretary Clinton, was seen as an integral part of that establishment. So here we are. Matt, as you and I know well, the former governor of Massachusetts, Bill Weld, is on the trail. He has articulated a strategy where he believes if he can get sufficient support in New Hampshire, not even a win, but a kind of a Gene McCarthy strong showing, he can begin to turn the tide. Any likelihood of that?
I'm skeptical, although competition is good. As you know, no elected president who sought re-nomination has been denied that re-nomination since, I think, going back to Franklin Pierce. So the odds aren't great if history holds. The Weld candidacy, and again, I'm speaking at a little bit of a disadvantage. I had tried to get to one of his rallies in New Hampshire. It turned out it was at 7 in the morning, and it was part of a bird-walking tour, which may say a lot about Governor Weld's campaign.
Okay.
I'm just dubious. And one of the reasons is it is just so difficult to defeat a sitting president because the president can suck up all the oxygen in the room and has a lot of means to sort of garner media attention. Governor Weld, bless him, but he is running a shoestring operation here. Now, that may change. You and I are hoping he will come to Middlebury College in the near future, and maybe his message will begin resonating. But I don't see him capitalizing on an issue such as against the Vietnam War that, catapulted Eugene McCarthy in 1968 to second place in New Hampshire.
Tough road to hoe, no question about it. We've got a call from Fred in Duxbury. Go ahead, Fred. You're on with Professor Matt Dickinson.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Hey, I would be one of those swing voters, I guess you'd say. I voted Republicans and Democrats. I don't understand some of the thoughts of the people that they're a hard line, no matter what they say, the candidate says, their political person, they vote Democrat their entire life, regardless. Or they vote Republican, regardless. My wife and I tend to vote seems to best resonate or fulfill what we say. I voted for Obama the first time. I voted for Bush. Read my lips, no new taxes. I voted for Obama. You can keep your health care and your rates are going down. And it necessarily wasn't that I voted for Trump because he was Trump. It was the less of two evils. The Democratic Party just didn't have anything worth it. There were a lot of people, regardless of what they thought about lines, were not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I think you got the situation now with the old white guy who's just, cozying up to everybody and every issue to get that vote. one of the strong things that a lot of people I know, including myself, was voted for Trump because he wasn't a classic insider Washington politician. And I think that is what appealed to many, many people that I know of, that he wasn't a classic politician. And I still think he has, but I think he's going to be the nominee. And I just don't think the Democratic Party has really a leg to stand on with the guy. It's not just about gun rights or abortion or anything like that. It's just too much of the same politicians from the past. And Mr. Douglas, I've seen you with Russ, and you're a funny guy, and I did vote for you. And I think I really appreciate the shows that you do also.
Well, thanks, Fred, very much. And Matt Dickinson, Fred is the classic swing voter, I guess. And perhaps thinking back to your first answer of our conversation this morning, a fringy leftish nominee is not going to attract somebody like Fred.
Yeah, this is Fred. It represents what is, in many respects, the most important demographic in a presidential race. You go into these races, he points out, with committed partisans on both sides who are pretty much going to pull a straight party ticket, particularly as these parties have become so well-sorted ideologically. So who provides the volatility? It's the people like Fred who are willing to switch back and forth. And there's not a lot of them. Maybe 15% of the electorate falls into that category, 15-20%. But the fact that they are not automatically attached means their vote is most crucial. But the difficulty is, as you say, you got to get a nominee who can attract that support. And that's where the problem both parties have faced in recent years, because your nominating process can be dominated by the activists. Those are the ones who are paying attention now in the race. They're the ones who are contributing these small dollar amounts to the Sanders and Warren campaign. They're the ones who are out there beating the bushes and endorsing. And they have strong views. And so if a party, and we've seen this repeatedly, if a party nominates a candidate who, you know, may be in the mainstream of that party's activist base, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to attract sort of those swing voters. And this is one of the reasons why our electoral politics seems to swing back and forth so much. It's because, you know, we nominate these candidates, sort of rejecting the other ones, and then they push the agenda too far to one side, and we say, throw them out and bring the other people in. I think if you're a Democrat, this is one of the questions you have to ask yourself. What's the relative importance of purist progressive policies versus getting somebody who can appeal to Fred?
Well, Matt, we've got less than a minute left. Very quickly, what do you think about congressional races? We've seen 15 Republican members of Congress announce their retirements already. Is that a sign that they don't see a majority anytime soon?
It can be, although I would point out most of those resignations are in solidly red districts, so we're probably not going to see them flip. But yes, generally when you have high retirement, it's because the party doesn't think they're going to regain the majority and they're not going to be in a position of influence, particularly in the House. It's going to be an uphill climb for the Republicans to retake the House, and certainly the Senate is in play, but there's no guarantee there either.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank Professor Matt Dickinson of Middlebury College for joining us this morning, talking about the early stages of the presidential campaign for next year. And Matt, I hope we'll have the chance to talk again.
I hope so as well, Governor.
Take care. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Secretary Lindsey Curley. This is Jim Douglas.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Welcome back. Jim Douglas in this morning. We had a great conversation with Professor Matt Dickinson about the 2020 presidential campaign cycle. Hard to believe it's on the horizon already, but he's a keen observer, a very knowledgeable fellow, a scholar and author, and we're glad to have had the chance to get his perspective at this early stage. We're going to shift gears now. We're delighted to have on the phone Lindsay Curley, who's been Commissioner of Labor for the last couple and a half years of the Phil Scott administration and has now assumed a new responsibility as Secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor to be joining you this morning, Governor.
Well, I guess we ought to start at the beginning. Give us a quick introduction to yourself and to your new responsibilities and how your perspective will serve you well as you undertake the role of Secretary of Commerce.
Absolutely. So this is my first week as the Secretary of the Agency of Commerce. I've hit the ground running. I've been traveling around the state just in these last 3 days, meeting with businesses and, you know, continuing conversations about their challenges, their successes, what the state's doing well, and what we might consider doing to help them and maybe, you know, break down some barriers. What I learned during my time at Labor is that there are incredible things happening every day in the state that we just don't discuss enough. We don't do a really good job sharing the good things that we're doing. And I think under my leadership at Labor, along with my team, we were very successful at getting more Vermonters engaged in the workforce. We worked hard to try to get folks who are maybe standing on the sidelines and needed a nudge or needed a little bit of flexibility, just a little bit of help. And we collaborated and coordinated with other agencies. So there's a lot more to do, but I feel like the work that we did there will carry over well into the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Just to give you a little bit about my background, so I grew up in Vermont. Obviously, I'm native Vermonter, grew up in Montpelier, and graduated from Montpelier High School and then St. Michael's College. I have a degree in accounting. I have a strong financial and accounting background by, training and employment. But I've also run a small business, two small businesses with my husband for the last 15 years. And I feel that the knowledge that I gained while running the business, you know, learning to, you know, take care of your employees who I think are your greatest assets, times going through a downturn in the economy, trying to make payroll. You know, I was responsible for people and responsible for their safety and their health and making sure that they could provide, you know, for themselves and their families. So, again, I feel like that background will serve me well in this new role, and I'm really excited to bring my perspective into it.
Well, that's a great background, someone who's been on the other side of the equation, so to speak, someone who, as a small business owner, had to navigate the state bureaucracy and understand how it could do better. And you're just like your boss, right, who was a longtime business owner himself in central Vermont. And that's the kind of perspective that I think allows Governor Scott and you to provide real leadership in trying to make the services of state government even more effective. So that's good to hear. You mentioned your success at the Department of Labor. We've got is it the lowest ever unemployment rate in Vermont now, about 2.1%.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you've had great success in getting people jobs. Virtually everybody who wants a job has one now.
Absolutely. And, you know, I just, you know, want to hit caution a little bit in terms of celebrating that. So for certainly job seekers, this is a great time. This is a great time for them to enter the workforce. As I mentioned, if they've been sitting on the sidelines, this is a time where they can try something new, something different. However, with that, obviously, comes a real challenge for employers. And, you know, when I'm visiting employers, what I'm hearing is that they are having a hard time finding people that are available and skilled to start, like, immediately. And, you know, again, a historically low unemployment rate, you know, that makes it hard as an employer to find folks. That being said, what's really unique about this is the employers are getting very creative in terms of what they're offering to set themselves apart from people. So It's a good time for businesses to really sort of dig deep and say, what might I change to make myself more attractive? I've heard stories of manufacturing companies who are changing their antiquated means of their work hours to accommodate people who need a little more flexibility. So imagine maybe folks who have retired but don't want to completely leave the workforce, but they don't want to work full-time either, right? So there might be opportunities for a little bit of a different shift or maybe some job sharing. Also imagine people who say, I'd like to be there to put my child on the bus in the morning and I want to be there to collect them at the end of the day. So I'd love a job that fit in between those, you know, time frames. And what we're seeing is employers are saying, hey, we need to change our way of thinking. And until, you know, the pendulum swings, these are, you know, some tools that we can use to help folks. The other thing that we're seeing is folks are really looking to populations that have been underserved. So think of employing people with disabilities, for example, great work ethic, really strong desire to do well. And there are so many supports within the state that I wasn't even aware of as a business owner to enable us to help people that do have some barriers to employment. We can help them remove some of those barriers and get somebody working who wants to work. We have, you know, New Americans, for example. There are programs where we have folks that will go into a business and work alongside them for a while, and that's supported by federal dollars. So there's really some great opportunities to, again, serve some long underserved populations of workers. And as a business owner, like I said, I didn't even know about many of them. So I'm excited to get out around the state more and share some of these things with folks.
That makes perfect sense. As a senior citizen myself, I'm working part-time, teaching part-time at Middlebury College, and I think a lot of older folks want to work longer, but not, as you say, a full week, as our energy level might begin to wane just a little bit. And you mentioned New Americans, Lindsay, and I recall vividly when I was state treasurer hiring a recent immigrant from the Baltic region who came to our country and didn't speak English, but was an accountant in the old country. And that's what I needed. Numbers are a universal language, and she did a great job. And in fact, she did such a good job, she was stolen by the tax department after working for me for a while. So you're exactly right. There are a lot of folks whom we don't think of initially who can really make a contribution to a business, and I'm glad you're focusing on that. We're talking with Lindsay Curley, the new Commerce Secretary, and Lindsay, I want to talk to you about one of the key parts of your agency, and that's housing, because you talked about the challenge of getting people into the workforce, the challenges employers are facing now, and some recent studies, some of them perhaps anecdotal, have suggested that the high cost of housing in Vermont is a key reason why people are not sticking around. So is there anything the state can do to try to alleviate that?
Yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, again, my own experience as well, you know, employers are saying some of the barriers for them and bringing people in are housing, childcare, accessibility and affordability, as well as transportation. And within, you know, housing and community development right here in the agency, we really understand that housing needs vary across the state. So when we're talking about tailoring the resources, and as you know, resources are tough, right? We'd love to be able to fix it all at once, but we have to try to, you know, figure out the right places to put it to really boost the economy and the environment and get folks into homes. So, you know, some communities, they need new units, and some need investments in the existing units that are maybe there, but maybe the stock is a little bit, you know, in poor quality. So I think that some of the balances try to figure out how to, you know, blend the state and federal funding resources to create affordable housing around the state. You know, we're working to address local zoning and statewide regulatory barriers to building more housing as lower cost strategies. So there's a variety of things that are going on. And to be honest with you, being here just 3 days, I don't think I've even scratched the surface of some of the great things that are happening, you know, within my own agency in terms of what we're working on. And I'm excited to actually learn more about that as well.
I suppose it's a little unfair to ask you about things 3 days into your tenure, but I know you're a quick study, and you've had a lot of experience in the public and private sector, and will hit the ground running. But it certainly was my experience that housing costs have been high in Vermont for some time. It's the lack of inventory that drives the prices up to some degree, and it's also the regulatory construct that we have here that's frankly, a little more onerous than it is in some other places. So I know you get it, and you'll get on it.
I do. And, you know, honestly, there are things that we're all encouraging, like aging in place, right? So what a great thing to be able to age in place. But at the same time, you know, your stock doesn't turn over as quick either. So that's, again, something I've just observed sort of on my own, within my own family, right, is, you know, people are staying in their homes longer. So there are, you know, I feel like, you know, we can crack this nut, but it's going to take some time for sure.
We're talking with Lindsay Curley, the Secretary of Commerce, about her new responsibilities at the agency. And we've got a call from Jan in Northfield. Let's put Jan on the line with Secretary Curley. Go ahead, Jan.
Yes, good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
I'm a businessman from the Flatlands, which is okay. I don't mind if they call me that. And I was invited to come to Vermont and move a manufacturing plant up here, which I'm now in the process of doing.
Great.
And to manufacture aircraft landing gear. But getting past that, what strikes me about Vermont is that it is capital shy. And when I look around at these local businesses, they all seem to run to a certain point, and then they hit a wall. And in order to move past that wall, they need an additional substantial sum of investment capital, which they can't get.
Mm-hmm.
So it struck me that one solution would be for what in Canada they call a crown corporation. But here you would be a quasi-governmental institution that would have access to a large sum of capital, a pool of capital, which would be available for investment. Now,
so what do you think, Lindsay?
Well, I haven't quite finished.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Sorry, I just have a little asthma.
The
source of the capital would have to come from some enterprise that would be outside the normal realm of government so that it's not directly taxpayer-funded nor taxpayer-guaranteed. I mean, that's obvious. There's too many budget constraints. And when I look around, I see a potential for raising about $1 billion from the sale of waste product that I see lying around the state. Now, it gets a little bit complex, but if you look at where Vermont is, it's basically been a mining state in the past, and there's quite a bit of scrap rock lying around. If you go up the 302 and you go past where Graniteville sits, you'll see these mountains that are just covered, the entire slopes of them are covered with boulders. Mm-hmm. That's about 100 years worth or 200 years worth of scrap rock in the mining of tombstones and whatever else they use for that granite. Now, there's a market for that. And the logical place for it, from the point of view of Vermont, is to sell it to the United States government, to FEMA, in one shot, where it would be used to build a large breakwater that would run for 7 miles along the eastern, southeastern coast of Staten Island. That area is only about 3 or 4 feet above sea level. And the last time that hurricane went in there, it flooded out about 500,000 people. Now, you have to kind of put this together. First, the legislature would have to declare that it's a hazard, and that if the business entity that owns that rock, or at least by inheritance, doesn't remove it in 1 year, then it will be escheated to the state. And they're not going to remove it. So now the state goes in there and removes the rock, loads it into gondola cars, ships it down to Staten Island, and it's used to build a dike 7 miles long, 16 feet high, which will consume quite a bit of material. And you sell it to FEMA at $50 a ton. Now, by my back-of-the-envelope calculations, there's $1 billion. You've got $1 billion in cash literally lying on the side of the road. That becomes quite a pool of capital. Now, if that capital falls into a bank, which we will call, say, the Industrial Development Bank of Vermont, which is a bit of the equivalent to operation of the Caisse des dépôts populaires in Quebec, you now have the ability to fund through bond issues or through some form of subordinated debt these companies that are attempting to expand but can't get the patient capital they need to get over that burden. Now, how do you sell it? Well, you're going to have to sell it to Donald Trump. This is where the problems come in. Nobody wants in Vermont wants to talk about Donald Trump. You know, he's anathema to the world. But what do you care? I mean, when you think about it, it's just a big government. They need the rock. He's a builder. He's from New York. Instead of trying to build walls and getting into arguments with Mexicans, he can build a wall and argue with the ocean. Nobody's vouching for the ocean at this point in time. Right? So it's a non-existent thing.
What an interesting idea, Jan. I mispronounced your name earlier. I apologize
that's
for
okay.
that. It's Jan.
Happens all the time.
Let me ask you, Lindsay, about another part of your agency, and that's the tourism department. Obviously, it's one of our major industries in Vermont. It's our brand. It's how we get so many millions of visitors here every year. Give us a sense of the state of the tourism economy and what, if anything, we could do even better.
Absolutely. You know, marketing works, and tourism is a huge driver of the Vermont economy. As you mentioned, tourism is a $2.8 billion industry here in Vermont. And after manufacturing, tourism represents the largest contribution of out-of-state money into our state's economy. So obviously very important for us to keep that, you know, going and really support that. There's $391 million generated in rooms and meals tax, which equates to $1,450 tax reduction for every Vermont household. And we have 13 million visitors that come to our state each year, and the tourism industry supports 32,000 jobs in Vermont, which is roughly 10% of our workforce. So very important, again, another very important area. And, you know, we really do know marketing works, and sometimes it's hard to show. And it's going to be important for us to show that our investments are making a difference as well.
Curley, our Secretary of Commerce, we've just been joined by a guest in the studio. Let me get his thoughts. Sir, how do you think Secretary Curley is doing in her new role?
Oh, she's done a wonderful job in her tenure as Secretary of Economic Development. She actually has done a terrific job in labor over the last couple of years. Her background in business, being a CPA, growing up in Vermont, I think has lent itself well to everything that she's been doing. So, she's done a great job.
Sounds like you have a fan, Lindsay.
Oh, thank you. The feeling's mutual.
Well, this Governor Phil Scott, I think our listeners are well aware. We're going to be chatting with him in the next half hour. And, Governor, we've been talking with Lindsay about her priorities, which, of course, are your priorities, and creating more job opportunities in Vermont, more housing, boosting our tourist economy. And there's certainly always a lot to do, even though we've got record low unemployment. Well, I know Lindsay's hitting the ground running. It's only her third day on the job, but she knows the ropes.
Yes, yeah, she certainly does. And, you know, there's a lot of symmetry between labor and economic development, and the two are so intertwined that we feel that this is a great match. And bringing someone over from labor over to ACCD, I think, is appropriate, and we'll be able to utilize everything, all the functions of both, and break down those silos, because they do work in tandem.
Well, we're running out of time in this segment. But,
well, I'll see you later then.
You're not off the hook yet. We're going to be talking with Governor Scott during the next half hour after the news. But I want to thank Lindsey Curley, the Secretary of Commerce and Community Development, for taking time out of her busy first week on the job to join us on the show. Thanks, Lindsey.
Thank you.
We'll be right back in just a couple of minutes. This is Jim Douglas.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Tone Code, Fashion Forward, Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Jim Douglas back in for Dave today. We're going to continue our conversation with Governor Phil Scott in just a minute, but we've got our... we're expecting a call from our friends in Washington at Vermont at what's it called? Talk Media News, right? But they aren't here, so let's forge ahead. And Governor Scott came in a little early and surprised his Secretary of Commerce, who was on during the last half hour. But she's a great example of a Vermonter with, like you, with a business background, stepping up to serve state government in a couple of different roles and bringing that perspective from working on the other side of that relationship. And I know she'll do a great job at Commerce, too.
Yeah, as you know, it's really important for your team to have different perspectives, come from different backgrounds, and bring different things to the table. And I believe that, you know, Lindsey and her husband, Jim, have had a great business there in Montpelier for a number of years, and understand the struggles as well. So bringing both of those, and again, having her accounting background, being a CPA, I think it just helps in many different aspects.
We haven't had a chance to chat in this context since the legislative session adjourned a few months ago. Give us a sense of how they did, how your priorities fared. How would you assess their performance?
Well, I thought we had a good session. I think it was very respectful and civil. We talked a lot, had some common goals, worked on the common goals. I didn't get everything that I wanted. They didn't get everything they wanted. So I think in the end, I think it was very productive, and it was something that you know, I'm proud of. And at the end of the day, we were able to get a lot of things, my initiatives that I think are important to the state, about growing the economy, making Vermont more affordable, protecting the most vulnerable. We were able to do something in legislation in each of those areas. But really, the bottom line is something that you brought up, you know, over a decade ago. It's about demographics. We are, you know, we have a stagnant population. We need more youth in the state. We need our workforce is struggling as a result. And I didn't listen to the first part of the program, but you know, we have 2.1% unemployment rate, lowest in the country. And other governors would say, this is great news, you know, and highlight this. But there's another side to the coin, and that is we need more people here to take the jobs that are available. We have over 8,000 jobs listed on our job link in the Department of Labor. We have 3,000, about 3,000 people on unemployment. That tells you a lot about what's happening in Vermont. We have more jobs than we have people to fill them, and that's part of our struggle, part of our challenge. We need more families here. We need to attract more people, and we need to use all the levers that we have, all the qualities that we have, and we have a lot of them. To bring more people into the state.
Well, as you say, there are a lot of help wanted signs all across the state. A lot of employers are looking for workers. Secretary Curley mentioned that She and her labor department role has reached out to groups in our population who haven't been working, retirees who might want to come back part-time, and I raised my hand.
Yeah, and you came in working right. Today. That's exactly. Thank you.
Yeah, the pay doubled
for doing
since,
your part.
Since I was here last.
Yeah.
Vermonters with disabilities who can right. make a real contribution. So so it's great. But you mentioned the unemployment rate, and I used to say that the low number is fine, but we need a bigger denominator.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's your point.
No, it's exactly right. And the reality is, again, we have fewer people working today than we did, about 10 years ago. So again, this trend that we're on, the trajectory that I'm so concerned about, and to the legislature's credit, understands it more now than they did previously. And they've taken some action in order to rectify that. And I think that, again, we've done some things together. We need to do more, pull all the levers we have. And so, again, a lot of promise. There's a lot of areas where I believe that we can do better. And we just need to continue marching in that direction.
We still have an affordability challenge in Vermont, without any question.
Well, again, some of what we're trying to do, putting more people to work, bringing more families in, is going to help with that, right? I mean, we have 30,000 fewer kids in our schools than we did 20 years ago. And we still have an infrastructure that's built for over 100,000 kids. We don't have them. So we need more kids, or we need to do something to become more efficient, because we're spending enough money. We're spending $1.7 billion to educate our 73,000 kids. And so we have, again, opportunities to do better there. That brings us into the affordability question. Much of what's derived for our education fund is through property taxes, and that's what a major complaint of many. So if we have more, as someone told me, and I use this a lot, I stole this line from a Burlington business person, he said, we don't need more taxes, we need more taxpayers. And he's so right.
Exactly right. Governor Phil Scott's our guest, and we've got Bob Ney on the line from Talk Media News in Washington. Bob, good morning.
Good morning to two governors.
Yes. Good morning, Bob.
I'm a former congressman, so we've got the entire government here.
And we accomplished about as much as they do in Washington today.
Well, you all get a lot more done than you get done, believe me. Speaking of governors, Governor Roy Cooper has warned the residents in the Carolinas, because that hurricane, of course, picked up, went down to a 2 in Florida, and then came back up to a 3. So they're bracing for some real problems there. And then on Brexit, this is the first time since 1783 that a prime minister has lost a vote when they've had their first votes as prime minister in the parliament in England. So that's a big loss for Boris Johnson. And what they basically have told him is, look, you're not going to exit the 31st on the Brexit. You're going to come up with something. We're going to extend this. So it's kind of a big deal.
Well, and, I guess those are the two big stories around the world today.
Yes, sir.
We hope.
And then trade talks in D.C., the Chinese are coming back. So we're going to watch that as it progresses.
We hope the hurricane doesn't come to Vermont. I don't think it's supposed to, right?
Well, I hope not.
We've actually gone to North Carolina. We have a 15-person team, Swift Water Rescue team, down there already. They went to Florida to begin with. There was some outreach from Florida, and then they got turned around. But then North Carolina stepped up and said we could use them. So we have a team staged there right now.
Oh, great! It's nice of you to help.
Well, we have what's called, you'll help me, Governor, with the name, but a municipal, not a municipal.
Emergency management, the compact.
EMAC. Yeah, that's right. Right.
Uh-huh.
Governors help each other out.
Right.
There you go.
Well, Bob,
well,
I wish we could talk longer, but I want to make sure we interrogate the incumbent governor here.
There you go. I'll email a couple questions for you.
Okay.
We'll see who interrogates who here.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Bob Ney from Talk Media News, for calling in this morning. We appreciate it. We're talking with Governor Phil Scott, of course, and let me ask you about a couple of specific initiatives that are, I know, important to you and to the state. You talked about expanding and recruiting the more of a workforce. There were some initiatives this year, the Some people were smiling about the incentives, financial incentives to move to Vermont, but we have to try everything, don't we?
Well, there's no one answer, and certainly I know that there was some. We had a lot of attention brought to the remote worker program, where there was up to $10,000 to try and attract someone from another state to come here and move here and then work remotely. And you know, some of the criticism, I want to make sure that we highlight that we received many calls from people saying, you know, that's great, you're trying to bring more people into the state, but what about me? You know, I've been living under this high burden of taxation for decades, and how about sending me a check for $10,000? And I totally get it. I totally get it. But that program there, we had over a million hits on social media. It received national, international attention. There were so many people interested. We had over 3,000 direct inquiries about the program in of itself. The reality was we only had enough money for about 25 to 50, but we filled it. I mean, what it taught us was, first of all, was that some people just want, they want to come to Vermont. They're just looking for a reason to do so. And to highlight that we have jobs, because for many, many decades, I think many thought that we didn't have any jobs available in Vermont, but that's just not true anymore. We have jobs, we have opportunities. And incentives work. And so, you know, the reality is that if we can bring more people into the state, as I said before, we need more taxpayers, not more taxes, it spreads the burden. So you're actually, every time we can bring someone in to work here and a new to pay sales taxes and property taxes and rooms and meals and all that, it takes the burden off from Vermonters who are struggling to get by.
Governor, I know one initiative that you've been working on that has been on our agenda for several administrations is expanding broadband access. That's important to a lot of businesses, remote workers, and companies here. And you had some progress on that this year.
Yeah, I mean, we're working with communities, it's not the complete answer for economic development, but it's part of the solution. It's another tool in the toolbox. You'd be surprised to hear. I was surprised to hear. When you take the top 12 areas that have the highest capacity, highest speed broadband in Vermont, names come up. Burlington comes up. That's not, you know, we would assume that they're on the list. But then you hear Springfield. You hear Brattleboro. You hear Newport. You hear Hancock. And they're not exactly all thriving economic centers of success right now. So it's not the complete answer, but it's part of the solution. And we need to highlight the fact that these areas do have broadband. I was talking to someone at a business yesterday in Richmond, really an interesting business there, by the way. But one of the employees moved to Underhill and says he has all kinds of broadband there. And he was very excited about that. And so there are pockets of high capacity, high speed access, but we need more of them. We need to work with the communities, see what we can do, make it part of their economic development agenda, and build the community in that respect. Make sure that we have that in the downtowns first, bring it out and expand it so that we can have more, again, more people attracted to the area.
Another key for a lot of working Vermonters is access to childcare, and you had a major announcement this week. Tell us about that.
Well, we've done a lot in terms of childcare. We've over the last 3 years, we've increased what we, you know, because I believe in a cradle to career process. I believe that fundamentally, a child's brain develops immensely fast between 0 and 5. And the sooner we can get to them, the sooner we can help, the better. We also know that if we want to put more people to work, they need to have childcare. Family, if we want to attract more families, we need childcare they can afford. So we were able to put more money in this year, $7 million for child care, and I believe that will help in a lot of respects in a lot of different ways, and so we need to continue to work on that. If we really want to bring more people in and more families, it's part of the solution.
Well, it clearly is. We've got to get access to child care. It's been on our agenda for a long time, and we've made some real progress over time. But we also have to make sure that folks can afford to go to college, and that's been a real challenge at the other end of the educational spectrum, and some real demographic pressures at our state colleges now, but we hope they can overcome them.
Yeah, our colleges, as you know, are under stress for a lot of the same reasons that we are as a state. It comes down to demographics. When you look at our state colleges alone, when you have 30,000 fewer kids in our schools, right, that has a ripple effect. Because I think the 90% of the students that attend our state colleges are from Vermont. So if you have 30,000 fewer of them in our schools, fewer students graduating, you have fewer going to our state colleges. So we have to come to grips with that. And again, trying to attract more people. We're not alone. I mean, we're seeing this throughout the Northeast. Some of the smaller colleges are a challenge, and it's all about enrollment. They don't have the product. They don't have the infrastructure. They just don't have the number of students enrolled. So it's taken its toll in Vermont. I'm afraid it's not over at this point, but I think the state college system is trying to address this. We have a great group on the board there, and we'll see what they come up with. But again, it's going to be dramatic, I believe.
We're talking with Governor Phil Scott, and I know, Governor, you're on your way to a press conference in St. Albans a little later this morning. Can you give us a scoop?
Well, we're going to give out some grants, the CDBG grants, and something that the federal government has been doing for a number of years. You probably remember those well. Giving out grants to different communities for housing. A lot of these are for housing, but for infrastructure as well. And they're worthwhile. And again, a helping hand to the communities, trying to grow our downtowns and make them even more attractive, I think is part of the answer. And we're seeing, some success in that regard. When you go to St. Albans, it's really, really a dramatic, it's so much different than it was 10 or 15 years ago. They've invested in the downtown with the TIF districts and so forth, taxing or rental financing. Not everybody agrees that that's the way to go. I'm a big fan of the TIF districts, and we've seen, again, you use St. Albans as an example, or Winooski or Burlington or Milton. They have improved their communities as a result. And I'm not sure the development wouldn't happen without these TIF districts.
I'm getting fond memories of the Winooski project from my time in office. And it actually started before my governorship, because I was on the board of VSAC, the Student Assistance Corporation, which is the major tenant in the downtown office building there. And I think you're exactly right. Winooski was getting a little run down, some of the mills not as vibrant as they were, and it was the TIF financing that really jump-started their urban renewal, and it's been a real success.
And they've got a lot going for them in Winooski right now. And when you look at the community and you see the diversity in the community, you go to the school, what a great school it is, and the number of students there, and the refugee population that has made Winooski their home has created just a different atmosphere, and I'm very, very pleased with the result. I think we need to, again, we need to do more, I believe, more with immigration, legal immigration, refugees, trying to extend a helping hand to those who need it. And we need more people here in the state. So I think it's part of the answer.
Well, Governor Phil Scott's our guest. The lines are lighting up, Governor.
Oh, great.
Everybody wants to talk to you, but let's go to Fred in Newbury and see what's on his mind this morning. Fred, you're on with Governor Scott.
Hey, morning.
Good morning.
Governor, you're the captain of a square rigger called a Vermonter, and it's caught in the doldrums. And all you can do is pray for a brisk northwest wind.
Well, I hope and believe the governor's doing more than praying, although that might be part of the answer.
Certainly, I think we can we can have a role. We have a role to play in our destiny, and I believe that we can't just sit back and wait. We have to take action. And again, my first day in office, I issued an executive order, and it really was about my administration, my team, keeping three things in mind: making Vermont more affordable, increasing, growing the economy, and making sure that we take care of the most vulnerable. And I think if we think those three simple guidelines, those three simple principles, and everything that we do, because we can't do everything, right? You understand that. I mean, you have to prioritize. So those are the priorities that we have for my administration. And I think we've had some success along the way, and we're going to keep working at it. And again, if we can work together, you know, instead of finding areas where we disagree, I'm looking for areas that I can agree with the legislature and others, so that we can actually work together to make something better for Vermont.
Well, a lot of good things happening. Obviously, the low unemployment rate, the projects you're going to celebrate today, the downtown development. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the fiscal status of the state now, because we hear news reports about pretty sizable projected surpluses. Are we flush? Or are you comfortable?
Yeah, we're never flush, because while, you know, the first 2 years when I was first elected, I put a line in the sand and I said, no tax and fees. We can live within our means. We're going to figure this out. And I'm not going to sign anything that increases tax and fees on already overburdened Vermonters. And we did that. We accomplished that. And after that first year, we actually had a surplus for the first time in over a decade. And we've had another one since. So that's the good news. But the unfortunately, as you are well aware, because you took the initiative back in, I think, 2008, to put us on the right track in terms of our underfunded liabilities, we needed to step up and make sure that we grow, you know, fulfill our responsibility with our pensions. So that bill comes due every single year. So any surplus that we have gets utilized and evaporates pretty quick when we try and pay off some of our debt, is what the issue is. And so we've taken half of that, whatever the surplus is, and pay down some of our debt. And we've worked together with the legislature and the treasurer as well in doing so. Good news, bad news, but I'd rather you know, have the surplus and start paying off making sure that we're fulfilling our obligation to our debts.
Got to pay our bills, no question about it. Let's go to Don in Elmore and see what's on his mind. Don, you're on with Governor Scott.
Well, good morning, both of you.
Good morning,
Governor Scott. If there's one way that we can improve the tax situation in Vermont, it is by adopting a constitutional amendment such as New Hampshire did in 84 that requires the state or the legislature to fund any project or requirement that they place on the municipalities and counties and towns and cities to provide. You know as well as I do that a lot of these people would not get reelected if they started spending money the way they've been spending it over the last few years. And the other place that I really think needs to be cleaned house with is the Agency of Natural Resources. The $100,000 that it has cost Morrisville Water and Light to fight their silly nonsense on recertification of the dams up here is something that Montpelier, all of you, need to be ashamed of. I'm sorry that you didn't put somebody in there who was strong enough to clean out the deadwood that we picked up with the Markowitz administration and ANR. And now we're looking at what they're dictating through AOT on slopes and everything, on town highways. I think you're going to find that League of Cities and Towns is going to get involved before we get through with that. We were talking about that at the Elmore Planning Board just last night. It's coming up again at the Select Board meeting here this month. It was already discussed at an earlier Select Board meeting this month. This is going to bankrupt the towns for stuff that they are just legislating, claiming it's going to be environmentally helpful. You can't tell me that sediment going into local brooks and stuff is going all the way to Lake Champlain and causing problems. What's causing problems in Vermont more than anything else is the Agency of Natural Resources, and something needs to be done about it.
Well, Don, let me get the governor's reaction to those two issues.
First of all, it sounds like we have a candidate on our hands here. You know, when I first decided to run, I didn't have any interest in politics whatsoever. But I was frustrated as Don seems to be, about what was happening. And so I decided to get involved. I decided to step up. Instead of complaining, I decided to, you know, add my voice. And you quickly learn that it's not as easy sometimes as you might expect when you get there. But I think different perspectives, different backgrounds are what makes the legislature work or not work. And I believe that we need different perspectives to do that. So first of all, I would advocate that Don might want to think about running for office. You know, we have elections. I don't know if you're aware of this, Governor, but we have them every 2 years here.
Really?
In Vermont. Yeah. Yeah. As opposed to
that's awfully frequent.
Yes, yeah, I agree. But again, different perspectives, and I understand the frustration that he has with different regulations, again, some of them are necessary though, you know, in terms of sedimentation, in terms of runoff, we're trying to clean up our lakes and streams and waterways, trying to do everything we can. In order to do that, and that was part of what we did this year was we had a dedicated source of funding finally to fill that last missing piece of the puzzle to fulfill our obligation to cleaning up our lakes and streams over the next 20 years.
And quickly on unfunded mandates to municipalities.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, our municipalities aren't they're not flush either, right? I mean, everyone's looking for more resources. And I would advocate, and I have to keep going back to this, we need to solve the demographics issue. We need more people here. We need to, you know, fill all the empty buildings and we need more resources. We need more people living here, paying into the system, spreading out the burden. So it's part of the answer for them as well.
Well, Governor Phil Scott, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us on the show this morning. We're out of time. We wish you all the best as you continue to move the state forward. The ship of state, as one of our callers said, we really appreciate your hard work on our behalf.
Well, thanks very much for all you did over those 8 years.
We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We're going to talk with Steve Perkins from the Vermont Historical Society. This is Jim Douglas.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Welcome back. Jim Douglas in today for Dave. We've had great conversations already this morning with Professor Matt Dickinson, Secretary Lindsey Curley, and with Governor Phil Scott. And our fourth guest this morning is Steve Perkins, the director of the Vermont Historical Society, the 100-and-how-many-year-old organization, Steve, that's been serving our state, presenting the past, educating Vermonters about our history. It's great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I always say almost 200 years.
Oh, well, it's close enough for government work, as we say. But,
sure.
I'm sure our listeners know the Vermont Historical Society is headquartered in Barre, has a library and museum there, and of course the Vermont History Museum and the Pavilion Building in downtown Montpelier. But of course you have a lot of activities all across the state as well, and we appreciate all that you do to keep Vermonters in touch with our very storied past. I know one thing you're working on now, Steve, is the installation of the second series statue that adorned the dome of the State House in a permanent home. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we all watched with rapt attention as the crane took the, I think, beloved statue off the top of the State House last year, and a brand new statue went up, gorgeous modern sculpture. But I think, at least I was asking, well, what's going to happen with the statue that came down? We were approached by the state curator's office about providing a permanent home for that sculpture, which was done in 1938 at the Vermont Historical Society. We, of course, have portions or pieces of the original statue carved by Larkin Mead way back in 1858 in our collection. So it seemed to make a really nice display so that we could talk about that early decoration of the State House. And we'll be putting it in the front end of the Vermont History Museum so you can take a look at it, and then you can actually peek out the window or step out onto the porch and see the current statue on top of the State House as it is right now. But it hasn't been an easy process to get this statue ready for the exhibition.
Well, interestingly, each of the previous two statues has lasted almost exactly 80 years. But I gather that the folks who carved the new one hope that it'll last longer. Is that right?
Yeah, the artist Chris Miller says this one's going to last 100 years. So I'm not sure I'll be around to test that theory, but we have him on the record saying that. Now, the statue that came down, you know, ultimately once it came down, it's in a warehouse and under the care of a conservator. It's okay. You know, it was certainly waterlogged. I think the reading was 97-98% of water content when a probe was stuck into it.
Wow.
But it has been completely dried out. It's stable now. There was a bit of loss around the shoulders and certainly a bit of loss near the bottom of the statue where it attached to the top of the State House. But the conservators down, guys who fix artwork down in Queechy have done a wonderful job with the head. And that'll be reattached to the body. The part of the bottom of the statue is going to be sliced off a bit that gets rid of some of the rotten pieces and allows us to mount it safely and fit it inside the Snelling Room, which is the front room of the Historical Society Museum in Montpelier. We hope to have that installed kind of mid-October. We're planning a big unveiling the last weekend of October, so the 26th of that month. You can come in and see the statue inside, see it up close, as well as seeing the tools that Dwight Dwinell used to carve the statue. And I think, Jim, you knew that the guy who carved the statue, Dwight Dwinell, was not a professional artist at all.
Right. He was not. He was the sergeant at arms of the State House. And of course, there's a lot of speculation about whether he did all or part of it, or who knows.
Yeah, we're leaning towards, or pretty sure, that he did the head.
Mm-hmm.
And we have great photographs of him working on that in a shed that used to be behind the State House, now where the cafeteria is. And he employed some of the young bucks who worked for him at the State House to do the body. And the body is made of all of these pieces of ponderosa pine, like 2x4s, 2x6s, that have all been glued together in one big chunk. And then, like, pieces of rebar pounded in there to hold it together. And then that was carved into kind of a rudimentary body. But the real artistry of that statue is in the head by this, you know, untrained wood carver who happened to be the sergeant at arms at the time. And he said, you know what, I can do this a lot cheaper than hiring somebody to do it.
That's the Vermont way, I guess. I've often ribbed sergeants at arms since then, asking, well, what have you done that's useful, like Dwight Dwinell?
Well, I was wondering why we had to hire an artist to do the new one. You know, isn't it the job of the sergeant at arms now?
Well, we'll talk to Sergeant Miller about that and see what she says.
See what she says.
But that'll be fun. So you can see the statue that used to be on top of the dome beginning on the 26th of October at the History Museum in Montpelier. So put that on your schedule. Steve Perkins, director of the Historical Society, is our guest. And another key project of the society over time is publications. You've published a lot of books that have brought our state's history to light, and the latest one is very interesting. It follows up on the conversation we were having with Governor Scott during the last segment on our demographic challenge and how we can attract more people to come and populate our state. Tell us about that book.
Yeah, so this conversation that we have about, you know, populating Vermont and what's going on with a population and an aging population is something that we have been having, you know, throughout our history, really since the Civil War on up until now. And so the powers that be, or the community of Vermont, was having these conversations in the early 20th century. And a Vermont historian, Paul Searles, teaches at Northern Vermont University, wrote a book using some case studies from the early 20th century about how Vermont started to address this issue of how do we attract people to our state? How do we get folks to settle in these communities? How do we stop young people from leaving the state and, in fact, get young people to move into the state? These were questions that were taking place in his book, he writes, that were taking place in the 19-teens, 1920s, and into the 1930s. And it's a fascinating look at how we as Vermonters during that time tried to address these questions, and, you know, for better or for worse. And it raises questions of how do we define our own community. So the book is very specific on these areas. One of them is a story of how Vermont wanted to move Swedes into certain parts of southern Vermont and had a program that lasted for a year to go to Sweden, recruit Swedes to bring them to a certain part of Vermont to be farmers. It didn't work. But it's an example of trying to build or define a community. We've now taken this book, and Paul and Amanda Gustin, who does programs for us, have been traveling around the state to libraries, and we've done this in partnership with the state library, to have book discussions where folks have read this book and then start to have conversations about their own community. How do we define community? Can you say, I want this type of person in my community, but not another type of person? And how do we do that? And how have we done it? And what's the future of Vermont? The conversations have been spectacular. And we planned them through the summer. And you can find those on our website, vermonthistory.org. There are a few left that you can check out. But now we're being approached by libraries and communities throughout the state, looking to borrow copies of the book, hold their own discussions. So many, many of those now going on throughout the fall. And we're even working with the governor's office to incorporate one of these discussions around his Cabinet for a Day program in a specific community. So, I mean, it really shows how the work of history is so relevant to how we think about our communities and civic engagement going forward.
Well, I read Paul Searles' earlier book, and so I'm sure this is a great piece as well. Look forward to it. I guess there's nothing new under the sun, is what you're saying, that this is a challenge Vermont has been facing for some time. And, of course, in the 1960s, we had the designation of the state as, quote, the beckoning country, unquote, where we tried to lure people in here with, you know, some success, I guess. But it's really the challenge of our time today.
It certainly is, and it has been. I think we were lulled a bit in the 70s and 80s. We did have a population increase. But beyond those the end of the 70s and the 80s, you know, we're having these same conversations. But we can learn from the past and hopefully build on that and make some good choices.
Well, let's hope. So go on the website, vermonthistory.org, and learn about where that's being discussed. And you might want to pick up a copy of Repeopling Vermont by Paul Searles. Another project, Steve, that you're involved in, I find fascinating. We talk a lot about literacy in its classic sense. I've been involved in some financial literacy programs to try to educate young people about personal finance and retirement savings and so forth. But there's a new concept called historical literacy. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so historical literacy, it's actually part of it's part of the educational outcomes for Vermont students now, and it's about how we think about the past. How do we have conversations with our neighbors about what happened before? How do we understand from each other that we all have a history, that we all have a culture? And how do you have conversations about that? How do you read even the media today, or how do you read a book that comes out and understand, you know, what's based in fact? What? How do you understand what good sources are, what not so good sources are? And then how do you take that information, process it, and use it to make decisions? This is all referred to as historical literacy. And, you know, like I said, our schools are using this concept right now to teach humanities. So we're very interested in it because it's what we do. We do it day in and day out, and we feel that historical literacy is what makes us human, and this idea of understanding each other, understanding where we all come from, makes for better communities.
It reminds me a little of my days as Secretary of State when legislators would come up with new ideas, at least they thought they were, and I would say, well, wait a minute, we've got 30 studies in the state archives on that very topic. Why don't you take a look at those before you move forward? So we have a lot to learn from our past, no question about it.
Certainly, and we're taking this a step further. You know, we all say this, right, that understanding our past makes better communities, makes us more civically engaged. These are great hypotheses. How do we prove that? How do we show that this study is important? So we're embarking on a multi-year program with Castleton University and the Castleton Polling Institute, which has been rolled into the university, to poll Vermonters. And so we're working on a scientific poll with them and with a series of classes of students to poll Vermonters and try to understand their level of historical literacy. We're not asking for facts. You know, this is not Trivial Pursuit, you know, or Jeopardy. We're trying to understand how Vermonters get this concept of historical literacy and where their historical literacy is. Once we create a baseline, we can then apply that to things like social capital and other measurable ideas of civic engagement, elections, people who are engaged in volunteering, and start to show, this is my theory, that historical literacy leads to greater civic engagement. So like I said, multi-year program, but we should come up with some great data showing the importance of understanding your past and being able to talk to your neighbors.
Makes good sense. We'll look forward to hearing the results of that. And you mentioned, Steve, the fact that schools are incorporating this into their curricula, and that leads me to remind our listeners that there are some kids who don't go to school, they're homeschooled, and the Historical Society has had a robust outreach to that community for many years.
Oh, absolutely, and that's just getting started again this fall. We have a special program called History for Homeschoolers, which will help those students enhance their history learning, and those are monthly programs at the Vermont Historical Society, special lessons. It's really most of the afternoon, working with our educators and exploring the museum on a variety of topics. But again, all that information can be found on the website, and highly encouraged for any of those homeschool students out there.
And that site, of course, is vermonthistory.org. It was, 25 years ago that the Society acquired the old Spalding Rated School in Barrie and moved in, and it's been an adventure, I can attest, as a former trustee of the Society. But you're full up now. There was a lot of vacant space there for some time, but you've got new tenants, and things are looking great, right?
We do. It's a hive of activity here. So not only is it the headquarters of the Vermont Historical Society, our library, our research center is here, as well as two galleries of great exhibits, but we also now house the Vermont Department of Libraries. So the State Library is here, and the Archaeological Heritage Study Center as well. So, you know, one-stop shopping for a lot of your Vermont research.
I remember for decades expressing concern about the proliferation of our historical repositories, and I'm glad to see some progress. Of course, the State Archives and Public Records Division were merged a decade or so ago over in Middlesex, and now VHS and the Library Department are co-located in Barry, so that's makes it a lot easier for researchers to, as you say, find, if not complete one-stop shopping, at least fewer stops than they used to have.
Two stops, and yeah. You know, it's only a couple of interstate exits apart. So,
I was reading in the most recent newsletter, which I receive, of course, as a member of the society, about trivia night. Tell us about what that's all about, and how people can get involved.
We've been having a lot of fun with these trivia programs. We started a couple of years ago bringing them around to breweries, craft breweries around the state of Vermont. This truly is the trivia. Unlike the historical literacy, this is testing your trivial pursuit knowledge about the state of Vermont. We do it in a series of rounds, and you can participate as a team or you can participate as a single person if you think you know better than a team. And we give out prizes every round and then grand prizes at the end. It's a lot of fun. You know, some of these questions are tongue-in-cheek, others are very, very serious. We do offer them in the evenings, and I could say the next one that's coming up is an afternoon, and it's set up for families. So we do have some family questions as well. So that's going to be at the Vermont History Museum in Montpelier on Saturday, September 14th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So drop in, try doing some trivia. We've got a lot of great prizes, and I will say after doing this, pretty much everybody gets a prize. And you can experience the museum as well. Take a ride through Vermont's history while you're there.
Well, Steve, VHS has been serving the state, as we've noted, for nearly two centuries. But part of the strength of our communities is the fact that we have local historical societies in many, many places around Vermont. Tell us about that network and how you interact with them.
Yeah, so there's over 190 local historical societies and small museums in Vermont. We, as the Vermont Historical Society, provide services to those small societies. We provide them, we have a full-time person that travels around the state and answers questions and helps everything from writing bylaws to, you know, how do you put this wedding dress in a box question. We offer workshops and conferences for those societies. This year we're providing scholarships so that members of local societies can attend the New England Museum Association Conference, which is happening in Burlington this year for professional development. And then we also advertise for all their programs, and it's called the Local Society E-News, and you can sign up for that on our website too, and that's something I think every Vermonter should sign up for because it's amazing. It comes out almost every other week, and there's got to be at least 20 programs, events, or exhibits happening every other week in all corners of the state.
And the website is vermonthistory.org. Unfortunately, Steve, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you, Steve Perkins, the Vermont Historical Society Director, for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
This is Jim Douglas. We'll talk to you again sometime. We hope you'll keep listening. Bill Sayre is next on WDEV.